From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. You knew caffeine made you more alert, but Johns Hopkins scientists say it may actually improve your memory. We sip some coffee and talk with the leader of the study. Then Wilma Foster recalls working at a Hagerstown airplane factory in World War II, a Rosie the Riveter.
I wasn't a real fancy little thing. I was okay because we had to wear heavy shoes, overalls, and a bandana around our head. You know, like you see the Rosie.
And her daughter tells us how she's working to find other Rosies. Plus, Tom Hall talks with Pakistani author Mohsin Hamid, author of the novels The Reluctant Fundamentalist, and most recently, How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia. And the environment in focus with Tom Pelton. First, the news.
I'm producer Jamila Kay. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock. That's on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming at WYPR.org. Now, on with the show.
This is Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast here on Your Public Radio. I'm Nathan Sterner. And yes, I am drinking coffee. As I very often am, my workday at WYPR starts around 4 a.m., and for me, coffee is an essential part of that day. The chemical in coffee that gets me going is caffeine. And new research shows that caffeine is not just a stimulant, it's also what scientists call a cognition enhancer. That is, caffeine can boost your memory. Dr. Michael Yassa led the team that conducted this study while he worked at Johns Hopkins. Yassa is now an assistant professor in the Department of Neurobiology and Behavior at the University of California, Irvine, and he joined me back in January to talk about his research. Your study shows that caffeine can strengthen people's memory. Exactly how did you do this study?
Right. So the first thing that we did was bring in people on the first day to study some material that we designed for them. These were pictures of everyday items that they saw on a computer screen one by one. And they were simply asked to look at these pictures and tell us for each one if it was a picture of an indoor or an outdoor item. And in reality, we didn't care so much if it was indoor or outdoor. We just wanted them to study the material to the best of their ability. And these were typical everyday kinds of objects like a picture of a telephone, a coffee mug, an office chair, and so on. And then we either gave them a caffeine pill, 200 milligrams, or a placebo, and then we sent them back home. And we brought them back the next day, and we gave them a memory test 24 hours later. And that memory test involved showing them some similar images to the ones they've seen before. Some of those images were identical to the ones they saw. Some were completely new, and some were only similar, but not identical to the ones they saw. So, for example, if on the first day I showed them a picture of a coffee mug, the second day they would see a picture of a slightly rotated or a different angle of that same coffee mug, or perhaps a different color coffee mug. And what we found was that the individuals that were administered caffeine as compared to the placebo were actually better at discriminating those items from the ones they saw. So they were better at saying, wait a minute, this is similar to something I saw yesterday, but it's not identical. And it tells us something very important about their memory. It tells us that the degree of detail by which they were able to store that original memory was better.
The person without caffeine would see a telephone both times, and even though it's a slightly different telephone the second time, they wouldn't notice. But the caffeinated person would remember exactly how that telephone was situated in the first image and be able to tell that it's not exactly the same picture the second time.
Precisely.
And part of what matters here is the short-term memory versus long-term memory. This is extremely oversimplified, but basically our brains store short-term memories and long-term memories in different ways, right?
Correct.
So the person who got caffeine ends up doing a better job of transferring more information from the short-term memory stack to the long-term memory stack.
That's a good way to look at it. So we think of this as a process that we call consolidation, or the process of strengthening or laying down memories such that they can be used at a later time. So for example, if I were to give you a phone number right now and ask you to just hold on to that in your memory for a few seconds before you have to dial it, you might say it to yourself a few times, rehearse it, and then once you dial it, that number seemingly disappears. So that number was in your short-term memory while it was being worked on or used, and now it's no longer being used and it doesn't need to be in long-term memory. But the kinds of things that we give them, the kinds of memories that we try to get them to encode, are very similar to everyday kinds of memories that we lay down. It's what we call episodic memories. It's memories for things that happen to you as you're going about your life, things that you learn. And those are often stored, a large quantity of them are often stored with a long-term use in mind. So this is useful information that you hopefully will use in the future. And even though we didn't tell them that they had to study this for a test, they had no idea they were going to get tested the next day. Our memory does this sort of naturally. It just assumes that anything that's novel to you is going to become useful at a later time.
And the caffeine made a little bit more of that information last longer.
Exactly.
You gave them the caffeine after they saw the images rather than before. What was the reason for that?
Right. So that's one of the most interesting features of the study, and it's actually very, very different from the past work that's been done on caffeine. Now, caffeine does have some well-known cognitive enhancing effects. So we know that it enhances your attention, enhances your alertness, your focus, your vigilance. And one of the questions that we wanted to ask here is whether it has an effect directly on memory, even after controlling for all of those other factors. Now, the only way to be able to do that is to, instead of administering it before, like you normally would, you administer it after the learning has happened. So you assume that now you're controlling for all of the other variables. And if you get an enhancement, it's only because caffeine had an effect on memory.
If you had given them the caffeine before, they might have been more alert, more attentive,
that might have contributed.
Right.
Exactly.
Would giving them the caffeine before do anything to not create this sort of memory-enhancing effect? Would it still work?
I don't think so. I think it would still work. You might even get a bigger boost because now you've got the memory effect combined with all of the other cognitive-enhancing effects. So you might be more alert, you might be more vigilant, and you might pay more attention. So that means more of the material is going to get in to begin with. And then in addition to that, more of it will stay in. It'll exhibit less forgetting, so to speak.
What was the optimal dosage of caffeine in your study?
So we did a dose-ranging study. We started out with 200 milligrams, and then we did a dose-ranging, and we tried 100, 200, and 300. And what we found was that at 100, we weren't getting the enhancement that we observed before. And at 300, we were getting the same enhancement that we got at 200, so there was no additional enhancement. But that was also the dose where people started to report some side effects, like jitteriness, headaches, and some nausea.
200 milligrams. About how much coffee is that if you were taking your caffeine and coffee?
That's about the 16-ounce coffee that I'm having right now. That's about 200 milligrams. So each shot of espresso, for example, is about 80 milligrams.
So several shots of espresso.
Right. So maybe, you know, a little more than a grande latte or something like that.
We have been a little bit pro-caffeine in this conversation so far. You mentioned the jitters. There are some other negative side effects to caffeine. I guess we should mention those, too.
Sure. So in larger quantities, of course, caffeine is a psychostimulant like any other. So it will raise your heart rate. It can have some unfortunate sympathetic nervous system side effects. So it can really increase jitteriness and anxiety, and it can cause a lot of shakiness and things like that. Those are the kinds of symptoms that people report. And of course, they vary quite widely from individual to individual. So people's sensitivity to caffeine varies according to their metabolism, their body weight, even their gender.
Those side effects aside, obviously, I am a fan of coffee. Are you as well?
I certainly am, yes, and have been for many, many years.
What's your preferred beverage?
I would have to say that I've switched now to drip coffee. I used to be a more of an espresso person, but I'm enjoying the perks that drip coffee has to offer, especially in Southern California. We have little coffee shops dedicated to just roasting and brewing drip coffee, and it's just fantastic.
I hope you continue to enjoy them. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Nathan.
Dr. Michael Yassa is an assistant professor in the Department of Neurobiology and Behavior at University of California, Irvine. You can find more information at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. For Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast, I'm Nathan Sterner. Hold on to your mug and stay tuned.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Go to our website to learn more about the segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in on the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast.
All the day long, whether rain or shine, she's a part of the assembly line. She's making history, working for victory, Rosie the Riveter.
It's a famous image, the red polka dot scarf, the blue work shirt, the determined face, and of course that curled bicep. It's Rosie the Riveter. Her face and "We Can Do It" message were icons of World War II propaganda campaigns. Rosie was a composite character, Millions of American women spent years working in factories and shipyards, producing equipment to be used in the war. They could do it. Last March, we were joined by one woman who did. Wilma Foster, who lives in Laurel, is a Rosie who worked as a riveter in Hagerstown during the early 1940s. Anne Marie Miller is the daughter of Wilma Foster. She's also president of the Laurel chapter of the American Rosie the Riveter Association. Anne Marie is what's known as a rosebud in the association. So I began our conversation by asking, what's a rosebud?
Rosebuds are the descendant from a Rosie, an actual woman who worked during World War II. And it's so wonderful because when the Rosies are no longer able to tell their story, the rosebuds will tell their story. Now, my granddaughters are Rosebud 2s. I'm known as a Rosebud 1 because I'm the first generation.
The first generation.
Yes.
Wilma Foster, tell us how you became a Rosie.
A Rosie. I was 16 when Pearl Harbor was bombed and was still in school, of course. And then everything after the war was declared and everything started, you know, we had to pick up ourselves because we were not thinking of a war or anything. We have nothing to work with. So in Hagerstown, there was the government, I guess, had a order for this small plane that the women's air service pilots for them to train on. So then my brother had a garage in Hagerstown, and he had a room above the garage where he turned over to the recruiting of the women that were coming to work on that plane. So I wasn't doing anything at home. And
home was in Virginia?
In Virginia, in Berryville, Virginia. We lived in a little town outside of Winchester. And he came home one Sunday, and he said, well, get your bag packed. I have a job for you. And that's how I got to be at Fairchild Aircraft and took my training to be a riveter and driller or whatever came our way on the wings of this little PT-19 plane. And you had to be 18 to be in the plant because of the machinery and everything. So I worked there for 4 years.
You had turned 18.
Mm-hmm. I turned 18 in February.
Mm-hmm. What was it like working there?
Well, I was from the country, so I wasn't a real fancy little thing. And I was okay because we had to wear, of course, heavy shoes and overalls and a bandana around our head, you know, like you see the Rosie.
Mm-hmm. Was the was safety a real big issue? Was that something
you really
focused on?
Very much. You had to be a little the gals that were delicate, they worked at the rivet bin, and they counted out the rivets as we needed them, and they couldn't handle the drills and the rivet guns and stuff.
Because they were heavy?
They were heavy, very heavy.
But you were strong enough to do that?
Yeah, to be a little bit tough. And we made lots of little planes, and they were assembled at the airport, Hagerstown. Every inch was taken up with war in that time. You know, it was just crazy.
Anne Marie, tell us about the work of the American Rosie the Riveter Association.
Well, our whole purpose is to find the Rosies and to tell their story. We're trying to get representatives in each state, and right now we don't really have that. We're very fortunate in Maryland to have two chapters. We have a Baltimore chapter that the ladies worked at. Glen L. Martin. Our Laurel chapter was started because we thought, well, there surely is some Baltimore, Washington on our end of the state, and we found 7 so far.
What should someone do if they think they know a Rosie who might not be in touch? I mean, how can people get in touch with the organization?
Yes, they need to go to the Rosie's the Riveter website. And when they go there, it'll pull up all kinds of information about who we are, what we do. It'll also give you forms to order Rosie items, because that's the only way that we don't have grants or anything like that. And that's how the Rosie Association works. They would also find a way to join
On 88.1, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Anne-Marie Miller, a rosebud who leads the Laurel chapter of the American Rosie the Riveter Association, and her mother, Wilma Foster of Laurel, who worked as a riveter at Fairchild Aircraft in Hagerstown during World War II. And Anne-Marie Miller, you are looking to collect more stories from women who served on the home front, right?
Yes, our Rosie Association has compiled, we have four books now. Keeping the Legacy Alive is the last one that we just published.
Wilma Foster, is your story in one of these books?
Yes, it's in the latest one that's out.
What is the headline of your story? What's the highlight of your story?
Answering the call.
Answering the call.
Mm-hmm. And I did.
What happened? What did you do when the war ended?
I came home in 1945. November of 45, and there was a family in our neighborhood that I knew, and there happened to be a real handsome man named Abe, and I married him 3 months after I got out of work, and he brought me to Maryland, and I had two daughters. And we were married 47 years, and he's gone. He passed away in 93. So that's been my life.
Sounds like a pretty great life.
Yeah, it's been all right.
And Marie, did you grow up with stories about your mother having been a Rosie the Riveter?
Not at all. My sister Margie, 2 years younger than me, and we knew that Mama was in Hagerstown with Uncle Elwood, but we didn't know why exactly. Mama really didn't talk about it until maybe 15 years ago at the most. And then's when we found that, well, these ladies and are Rosies that worked during the war. But, I mean, they weren't called Rosies then. All this came later. But Mama brought us up being patriotic. My dad was very patriotic, loving being here in the United States, and being disciplined children and obedient children, Christian family. And so we didn't know much about it until later.
So I have to ask you, Wilma Foster, why didn't you talk about it when your daughters were younger?
I ask myself the same thing. Because I had Anne-Marie right away, and I guess when I came home from the plant, that I just wanted to forget it because it wasn't much of a life. Mm-hmm. It wasn't fun. It wasn't fun. Mm-hmm. And I would only come home twice a month or something like that, and. Sometimes I wonder why I didn't. Now we have grandkids. You know, I have the great grandgirls that they want to hear about it. And Anne-Marie and Margie, I guess, didn't hear it outside of the home, so we didn't talk about it. And they knew their father had been with the motor pool at Fort Meade, and they knew he was there, but mine didn't seem to be as sketchy as that.
Huh. Maybe it's a question. Now. What does it mean to you, Anne-Marie, that your mother was a Rosie the Riveter?
Well, just like her story is called it, she answered the call. And she didn't, and she was called to do what she could do. And it means a lot to Margie and I that she was brave. She left home. She served and was obedient, you know, to her faith and family, and that's what really means a lot, you know. And she's a lady of history, mm-hmm. which is even awesome, is to know that she tells her story, and that's why her great grandkids, my granddaughters, they're learning about this in school. So here, when Mama comes to their school. Here's a lady that lived it, and it's not just in a book.
There is a song from that era that is almost as well known as the poster I talked about earlier, the Rosie
Rosie the Riveter song, which mm-hmm. I guess the best known recording was by
Kate Kaiser.
Mm-hmm. Kate Kaiser. Mm-hmm. But can you sing some of that? Do you know a few lines of it?
You want to sing it, Mama?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay.
You gonna sing too?
Mm-hmm.
All the day long, whether rain or shine, she's a part of the assembly line. She's making history, working for history. Rosie the Riveter keeps a sharp lookout for sabotage, working up there on the fuselage. That little frail can do more than a male can do. Rosie the Riveter. Rosie's got a boyfriend, Charlie. Charlie, he's a Marine. Rosie is protecting Charlie, working overtime on the riveting machine. When they gave her her production E, she was as proud as any girl could be. She's something new about, Rosie the Riveter.
You ladies are very good. Thank you so much.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Wilma Foster of Laurel, who worked as a Rosie the Riveter in Hagerstown during World War II, and her daughter, Anne Marie Miller, a rosebud who leads the Laurel chapter of the American Rosie the Riveter Association. We have a photo of Wilma Foster as a riveter and more information about the American Rosie the Riveter Association on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. More of this interview there, too, including what Wilma Foster wanted to do when her days at the plant were done and questions her grandchildren ask about her years as a riveter. And you can see a photo of a PT-19 trainer at our website or the plane itself at the Hagerstown Aviation Museum. The next event is September 21st. We have that link at our website, too. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We are at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
The Pakistani author Mohsin Hamid has written three acclaimed novels. His first, Moth Smoke, was a finalist for the Penn Hemingway Prize. The Reluctant Fundamentalist, his second book, was a New York Times bestseller, which was published in more than 30 languages, shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize, and made into a movie last year. His latest book is called How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia. It's a fantastic, trenchant look at the life of a man who journeys from indigent child to wealthy industrialist. And it's written as if it were one of those self-help, get-rich-quick books that are ubiquitous in bookstores around the world. Here's Mohsin Hamid reading from the opening chapter of his novel.
This book is a self-help book. Its objective, as it says on the cover, is to show you how to get filthy rich in rising Asia. And to do that, it has to find you, huddled, shivering, on the packed earth under your mother's cot, one cold, dewy morning. Your anguish is the anguish of a boy whose chocolate has been thrown away, whose remote controls are out of batteries, whose scooter is busted, whose new sneakers have been stolen. This is all the more remarkable since you've never in your life seen any of these things.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. I spoke with Mohsin Hamid last March, just before he came to town for an appearance at the Ivy Bookshop. He joined me on the phone from St. Louis.
Good morning.
I'm so delighted to talk to you. This book is a terrific, terrific read. Congratulations and thanks for this really great piece of writing.
Thank you very much.
Of the many things there are to admire about this book, the structure is certainly one of them. How did you come to formulate this story around the concept of a self-help book?
Well, it started as a joke. A friend of mine and I were laughing about how sometimes reading literary fiction can seem like hard work. It's like doing self-help. But the more I thought about it, I thought, you know, maybe writing novels for me really is a kind of self-help. Maybe there's something, some way in which I help myself by writing fiction. And maybe even reading novels helps the reader in some way. So what began as a joke by the end became pretty sincere.
Do you think really that it's true most of the time that reading literary fiction is hard work? I didn't find reading your book at all hard. I found it delightful, and I was sad that it ended.
You know, I think it's the stereotype that reading literary fiction is hard work. Actually, of course, you're right that so much of what's written is a real pleasure to read.
You make two very interesting decisions to tell this story. The first is that none of the characters are named. We never know the protagonist's name. The love of his life is referred to throughout the book as simply the pretty girl. What do we know or not know about a character when she or he is named or not named?
Well, I think, you know, sometimes when we use names, the names bring with them a whole series of expectations. So when you use the name the United States and you set a novel in New York City, that creates certain expectations. If you set a novel in Pakistan and you use words like Islam and you name people with names that people have in Pakistan, immediately you're in a particular political setting, you're in a kind of exotic setting. The nice thing about not using names is that everything becomes human again. Every person is what they are and how they behave instead of what their name is. Every country is what it's like to live there instead of what the newspapers tell us about the place.
That's fascinating. The other decision you make is to speak this novel in the second person. Reminded me of Jay McInerney's book from the 80s, Bright Lights, Big City. I mean, only in that way, in that it's in the second person. And you sometimes refers to the protagonist who's talking about himself, and sometimes it's a direct statement to the reader. Again, is this what do you gain and not gain by using second person instead of first person or third?
Well, I think in every novel, the reader is helping to write the novel with the writer. You know, a novel is just words on a page, but in a reader's imagination, it becomes people and images and all these things. And so I think the reader is always part writer and part character. When you use the word you, though, you're making it a bit more explicit, and you're inviting the reader to play a bigger role than perhaps is normally expected. The other thing I think about using you to blur the distance between who the character is and who the reader is that this is a form that's been used for thousands of years in a particular kind of love poetry that exists in Pakistan and other places called Sufi love poetry, which are basically love poems that talk about how you can relate to the universe, how you can relate to life and the divine, as though you are a beloved speaking to you.
My guest is Mohsin Hamid. His latest novel is called How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Let me ask you to do what I'm afraid to do, and that is tell us a bit about the main character and the love of his life. I'm always afraid that I'm going to spill too many of the beans, so I'm going to let you make that decision. Can you introduce us to those two main characters at least?
Sure. Well, right now on planet Earth, a billion people in the next 10, 15 years are going to move from the countryside to the cities of Asia and Africa and Latin America. And you, the main character, is a boy from a very poor village who moves to the big city, lives in a slum, and meets a young woman whom he will call the pretty girl for the rest of her life. And both of them set out in different ways to become rich and famous, and their lives keep intersecting. They don't really wind up necessarily together in the novel, but they stay in love in a way and keep bouncing into each other. And the novel follows the arc of their lives from childhood through old age.
So you live in Lahore, Pakistan, is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that, you know, you don't name the city just as you don't name the or you don't name the country or the city in the novel just as you don't name the characters. But it's assumed that it's someplace like Pakistan, perhaps. And it paints it, is that an unfair assumption on my part?
Well, I use Lahore, Pakistan as my model. But interestingly enough, a Mexican team of filmmakers has optioned the book to make a movie. And when they called me to discuss doing that, the first thing they said was, this could be set in Mexico City. And when I've traveled in India or to Indonesia and Jakarta, people have said similar things, like this could be set in our city. So in a way, I used Lahore as a model, but I was trying to say something universal about these new emerging megacities throughout, you know, the third world. And hopefully that's how the book reads.
Well, let me ask you a question that's specific to Pakistan, because you live there and you're such an important part of the literary scene there. You paint a very grim picture of this city in the novel, of a place full of graft and corruption that sort of permeates the entire economy, and this severe bifurcation of haves and have-nots. And you examine various divides. I mean, the economical divides, the rural-urban divide, the literate-illiterate divide. These same divides, as you say, you know, can define many cities and many places around the world, certainly many in America. And here in the U.S., President Obama and many others have taken up this issue of income inequality. I wonder, are there those in Pakistan who are taking up this issue as well? I mean, is there a movement to address the disparity between the very wealthy and the very poor?
Well, I think it's a bit like the U.S. You know, people talk about it a lot, but not that much is being done. And, you know, it's very difficult to address this issue, but it's a vitally important issue because in many ways I spent in the 1970s 6 years of my childhood in America. My father was doing his PhD here. My father's a university professor. And I remember the America of the 70s. I went to a public school as being a much more equal time in America. So you're right that Pakistan and America are sort of both heading towards, you know, greater inequality. The difference is in Pakistan, because there's so much more poverty to start, the violence and unrest that comes from that inequality is more stark in a place like Pakistan.
What's the literary scene like in Pakistan?
There's a real excitement, I think, particularly among young people. You know, one thing which is happening in Pakistan is the university population is exploding. There's hundreds of thousands, a million university students now in Pakistan. And these young people are reading novels, you know, with, I think, an enthusiasm that we've never seen before. So in that sense, it's really exciting, the literary world over there.
I mean, how would you generally assess the standing of literature and the arts in Pakistan? I mean, again, so many Americans, I think, get a pretty monolithic view of Pakistan and contiguous countries in that part of the world, given the violence that is taking place in so many parts of that part of the world. What's your take on how pervasive and how well recognized the literature and art scene is in Pakistan?
Well, I think it's actually quite striking when you come to a country like Pakistan, the amount of love and respect that there is for the arts. So the city of Lahore, where I live, is a city of 10 million people, and one of the most important sites in Pakistan is a place called in Lahore is called Data Sahib. The shrine of a writer who lived 1,000 years ago, and even today, thousands of people every day go to this shrine to seek, you know, cures for their ills and enlightenment. And it's like a pilgrimage site. And that ancient veneration for writers and artists very much continues today. So much so that when I go onto university campus in Pakistan, the kind of, you know, in a sense, love and respect and affection that the students have for me, just because I am a writer or an artist, is breathtaking. So despite what I think we often hear about places like Pakistan, the culture really elevates the rights and the writing and the arts very much.
And your own road to becoming a novelist is interesting. You, as you said, you were here as a child in elementary school. You also attended Princeton and even Harvard Law School. And I guess you worked in the corporate world for a little bit. What were you doing in that capacity?
Well, I worked as a management consultant in New York and London for about a decade.
And what brought you to writing novels?
Well, I was writing novels the whole time. For about 20 years, I've been writing fiction now. And I never really thought I could make a living at it. And so I assumed, you know, I had to have a job and I had to work and do other things. And I'm really glad that I did, because the experience of working in New York and working in London and traveling the world on business taught me a lot. You know, I got to see the world. I got to see what it was like to earn a living, interview for a job, see people getting fired. And so I think it affects my writing, because I've had an intimate experience of being part of the workplace, which, of course, for most people is how they spend most of their days.
The author, Mohsin Hamid. His latest novel is called How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia. It's published by Riverhead Books. We spoke last March. He's got a new collection of essays that's scheduled to be released in February of next year. You can come to WIPR.org/Marilyn Morning for a link to more information. That's it for us today. On Friday, Sheila explores how Maryland became Maryland, and I'll talk to a particle physicist about how the universe became the Universe, a show about becoming, all coming up on Friday's edition of Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. Our program is an original production of Your Public Radio, WIPR, in Baltimore. To learn more about what you've heard or catch something you've missed, head on over to our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Maryland Morning is produced by Matt Purdy and Jamila Kay. It's directed and engineered by Nathan Sterner. It's made possible by you. We're very grateful for your listening and for your support. For Sheila Cast, I'm Tom Hall. See you Friday. Have a great day.
I'm producer Jamila Kay. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Thanks for listening.